Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Eason, here with Jake Town. It's Thursday, May 17, 2012, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. Lots going on over in Europe. The euro in trouble. Greece and Spain at the head of the whole thing. We'll be doing a lot of time, spending a lot of time on that coverage. Plus, we're going to take a look at that $2 billion J.P. Morgan loss, which is still kind of shaking the roots and foundations of the financial structure and doing it in ways that, to be perfectly honest, take me back a little bit because it makes me wonder, well, geez, where do they think, what do they think the banks are doing in the first place? We're also going to look at what's been going on with the Paul campaign, other news related to the U.S. and Israel. But at the top of the hour, we're going to start off with the big news on Wall Street today. That's the Facebook IPO, long-awaited, long-anticipated. It did debut today. It came in at $38 a share and raised $16 billion in one day, making millionaires out of, or billionaires, I should say, out of those Harvard grads who created the whole thing in the first place, including the one fellow who put up a $30,000 bet on it. Not a bad investment, Jake. What do you say?
Yeah, one has to wonder how long they'll stay employed by Facebook.
Have you seen the movie that was done about them? It adds further to the whole question about how long they will stay employed.
Right. The Social Network.
The Social Network. Yeah, that was quite a story. I don't know how fictional or true it is, but it was still quite interesting. But
yeah,
nevertheless,
well,
this is the biggest thing since Google, really, and a lot of noise has been made about it. And $16 billion, I mean, that's a very respectable IPO.
Well, the price of $38 a share would value the total number of shares that they're offering at somewhere around $104 billion. We'll have to see how it trades in the market during normal trading days. But that figure places it about half the market cap of Google, about a quarter the market cap of ExxonMobil, which was the world's largest company before Apple, and it's about one-fifth of Apple's market cap. So it's pretty, they're trying to value in, the future ability, and certainly it is a very widespread social network by not just here in the U.S., but in a lot of other places, too. So we'll have to see what goes on next.
Well, I think one of the things that will go on next is Facebook has, for quite some time now, gotten a lot of criticism, quite justifiably, regarding its privacy policies and how customer data is handled and so forth. I suspect that's going to probably ratchet up even more than it already has. And I think probably the untold story, if you can say it's untold, out of the whole Facebook phenomenon is the way that they grew the company, because they basically didn't sell hardly anything until they'd had, well into the millions in subscribers. And that was rather unique. That had not really been done very much before. In fact, I can't think of any major launch in recent times that did that. That it makes me wonder, is this the new model for building a business and attracting investment capital?
Yeah, no, like you said, they needed to have the critical mass of, I guess, possible future consumers. And by offering, this social network, which caught fire very quickly, they were able to achieve that critical mass. And it's, the web has given way to quite a few things, the business growth is not typical. For instance, like e-books. I was reading an article today about how e-books are being sold, for $2 or $3 or whatever online under Amazon, and they're making the authors quite a bit more royalty than if, people were picking up hardbacks for $25 or so.
Although you also have the people who are trying to be the quasi-monopolists. There's a lawsuit, I guess a federal lawsuit against Apple and a few others for trying to jack up the price of e-book.
Yeah, of course. You shouldn't be able to decide what the price of things should be, but that's the federal government coming in there. And it's just there was an article, I think it was on Mises.org this morning that went directly into this, and it talked about how you know, when the compared the U.S. government with these e-books things to like the people that, you know, when the printing press came out, you know, there was people that you know, wanted to stay employed by copying books. That's obviously how books were made prior to the printing press. And you know, we should all be happy that you know, the e-books out there, you know, there's still, for some people, for many consumers, there's no substitute for a paper book. But that doesn't prevent the fact that you know, this very commodity that's out there, and people are able to purchase it and, you know, open it up on a viewing screen, and, you know, it is very similar to purchasing a book, but it doesn't have the production costs and stuff associated with that.
I have to admit, too, I haven't, first of all, bought one of the readers or you know, an iPad tablet or something like that yet, and I keep putting it off. But probably the one thing, more than anything else, that will encourage me to get a full tablet, not just a reader, but a full tablet, will be the ability to read an e-book on it, because, I mean, they're very light, and they kind of have the same orientation in terms of when you hold it as a book. Now, certainly for a purist who likes holding a book, it's not the same thing. And yet, I would have to say, as the younger generation becomes the next generation, and the older generation dies off and so forth, we're going to see a lot less of the thing that you held in your hand that had the pages in it.
No, I think you're right. And, you know, I've just been using my iPhone, which is not a good substitute for a Nook because of the screen.
That's one heck of a way to read a book, I got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, it's convenient for different locations. But
do you read, like, ways. 50 words at a time? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, that's the tough part.
Like, well, boy, I hope this is a short chapter. Oh, my. Well, the Facebook IPO could not have come at a better time as far as Wall Street and indeed the world financial situation is concerned, because it distracted attention, quite surprisingly perhaps, but it distracted attention effectively away from what's going on over in Europe, where things continue to deteriorate. As we reported last week, the crisis is not coming. It's upon us, and the media are beginning to notice that. They're actually talking about what happens if Greece leaves the euro, and this week's bond auctions did nothing to dispel any of that talk, did they?
Yeah, it's funny how, you know, just now, you know, they're talking about the same things that we've been covering, I don't know, for, it seems like the past year, but it might just be like the last 6 months.
Well, it's probably just because it's us who are doing it, that's why.
That's right.
But anyway, give us the details on what's going on with the bond market, because I know the Spanish bond market came in a little bit higher than expected and kind of worried people who were already worried to a greater degree than before.
Well, as we've covered previously on the show, the Spanish debt has been right around the 6% mark on a 10-year bond, which is looked as many investors as kind of like the cutoff point before things get pretty bad. And it's gone into a crisis area the last 2 days. Currently, it's at 6.3%. So it's one of those things that needs to be monitored into the future. Certainly, you know, the skyrocketing Greek bonds that we saw earlier can certainly happen to one of these larger countries, but the implications will be far greater because the comparative size of Greece and the EU's entire, I guess, economic strength is, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Walt, somewhere estimated around 3%. So it's a fairly minor part, and a lot of the conjecture is really a result of the last election, which was pretty much the Greek people showing up at the voting booth and voting for the people that would promise them the most goodies and to keep their government jobs running, since the entire area is highly dependent on the government for its work. And you know, the people that are elected, they would be the ones that would tend to make a top priority of staying in the EU, because that means that they get to keep getting the free purchasing power from all these bailouts from the richer EU nations, such as Germany. So, you know, there's been talk of Greece leaving the EU, but it's, you know, some commentators haven't gotten into, but we have in previous shows, is, you know, what exactly is going to happen? Is, you know, is Greece going to get kicked out? Are they going to leave by themselves, which I think is highly doubtful? Is it going to result in something like the opposite, where Germany just throws up its hands and leaves the EU, which would certainly be far more significant than if the EU kicked out the Greek euro? But if they do, kick the Greece out of the euro, then what does that mean for all the other countries that also can't meet the yearly budget marks and have debt explosions, such as Spain and Portugal?
Absolutely true, and you're right that the Greek economy is a very small percentage of the overall eurozone economy. But so the question becomes, why is there such an uproar about it? I mean, people, you look at it and you say, well, why is that so important? Something we've talked about, but we haven't talked about a lot lately, is a concept which most economists won't address directly. They'll address it indirectly through a word known as contagion. And the implication of contagion, of course, is that there's a disease going on in Greece, and that disease will jump borders and start infecting Spain and Portugal and then work its way into the stronger countries until it goes all the way up to France and Germany. And this contagion is alleged to be the source of tremendous fear and alarm, because it could essentially bring the euro to its knees, bring the European zone to its knees, and essentially, you know, undermine the entire economic system. What they don't talk about, of course, and we've talked about it before, is what contagion means. What is contagion? I mean, what is this, like a cold that you pass along?
Yeah, it's money printing.
Money printing? Oh, no, it can't be that.
Yeah, no, and that's a very good point. It's not a cold or a disease. It's the government's just being completely fiscally irresponsible, and the population's kind of going along with it and not realizing it, and electing the same politicians that have the same spending practices until you crack up. So,
and one of the things they always point out is that the European Central Bank doesn't actually issue lots of new currency. So the question becomes, where does this currency come from? And again, this goes back to stuff we haven't talked about in a long time, but it's the real root of the contagion. The contagion is really nothing more than the fact that banks take money that was deposited by depositors and invested without their permission, in many cases without them even knowing about it. Some know about it, some don't. And then when they get in trouble with those loans, well, something happens. You end up with something known as a run on the bank. And that run on the bank ends up creating havoc, because all of the banks are involved in this same kind of game, because they're all involved with these currencies, which we call fiat currencies. And these fiat currencies are really nothing more than, you know, government dictated that this is what the currency is going to be for this country. And that, when you have that kind of scenario, then you don't have to actually be printing the money physically in order for the money supply to be dramatically increasing. The other part about this that's really fascinating to me is, despite the overwhelming evidence of how much the money supply is increasing, the Keynesians, the pseudo-Keynesians, the Keynesian supporters, and the monetarists, by the way, are all in incredible denial about how this entire system of fractional reserve banking and the way that it increases the money supply, how that actually, in their view, doesn't really matter. And yet, here they are complaining about contagion. I mean, it's almost like there's like two different personalities, like a schizophrenic situation going on here.
Yeah, and I haven't been monitoring the euro currency itself, but I heard that it's gone down against the dollar by like 4% or something around that point at some point over the past several days. Today, Moody's downgraded Greece. It doesn't say the exact rating, but it just says the headline is just deeper into junk on CNN.com. And Moody's has downgraded four regional government debt of Spain and Catalonia, Murcia and Lucia and Extremadura down as well. So, you have that currently going on. And you know, what you mentioned with bank runs, You know, if you're in Greece right now and you start hearing this talk, especially in the foreign press, of Greece leaving the euro, and if you understand what that means, that they would go to, the new drachma or something like that, but it would also be devalued massively against the euro. If you have a bank account, it might not be a bad idea to go in there and grab as many euros as you can in paper form. since, you know, the history is, you know, these banks lock up and don't feed out money when things go bad. And, you know, you also have to start asking, you know, the question in the other countries. You know, they might see, well, you know, if Greece stays in the euro, you know, it's going to get devalued, or, you know, there could also be a problem there. So it's going to generate more questions, I would say, with people in Greece, but also, you know, all the European banks that hold the Greek national debt have got to be getting nervous, because that would be a complete disaster for their balance sheet. So I can only imagine, you know, the BIS and the IMF and the European Central Bank and most likely the Fed, you know, readying, you know, whatever they're going to do next, you know, increase the swap lines, you know, from the U.S. or throw money at this problem to keep it, you know, under wraps. Because, you know, the political will, and by political will, I don't mean that of the people. I mean of the politicians and royalty in the EU. They really want the EU project to succeed. It's, you know, but this is what happens. You know, one area gets to profit off all the others, and, you know, socialism. And it's not too good if you're the one getting leached from.
Absolutely true. And in fact, speaking of leeching, just yesterday, Bloomberg reported that Greek president, I'm going to have some fun here with some Greek names, Karolas Papalias, was told by the nation's central bank chief that financial institutions are worried about their survival as Greeks pull out euros amid a deepening political crisis. Well, this is where it gets really fun. Central bank head George Provopoulos told Papalias that Greeks have withdrawn as much as 700 million euros, that's $891 million, and that the situation could worsen. This according to the transcript of the president's meeting with party leaders on May 14th that was published yesterday, or published 2 days ago, actually. And the quote from the president is, the president of Greece is, Provopoulos told me that, of course, there's no panic, but there's great fear, which can evolve into panic. Not so sure about that quote, but okay. The other thing that I noticed today, Reuters was reporting on what you talked about, how the euro's been falling. In fact, they're talking about it possibly reaching as low as $1.20 per euro, which would be quite a drop from where it's been running. It's been running in the 130 to 150 range over the last couple of years. But in that article that appeared today, they, among other things, were talking about the possibility of not only a Greek exit, but also of runs on the bank. And in the course of that discussion, it was pointed out that many in Greece are actually leaving their money in the bank. I'm sorry, this was actually from a CNN article. The CNN article said that many Greeks were leaving money in the bank, and that they were doing it because they had confidence that that Greece would be able to stay in the European Union, and they wanted it to be a vote of confidence for the euro. And I said to myself, well, you know, that really shows a tremendous level of financial acuity and astuteness by the Greek people to be paying such close attention to what's going on with the crisis that they are making their decisions about whether to keep the money in the bank based on their desire to stay in the euro. I don't know about you, Jake, but I don't buy a word of that. I mean, the average person has no idea how all this stuff works. That's one reason we have a radio program.
Right. Exactly right.
I mean, I read what some of these people have to say, and I'm glad that, you know, the major publications are finally noticing that, you know, there are problems with fractional reserve banking. They haven't actually said that. I'm glad that they're finally noticing that there is a European debt crisis that is actually turning into a crisis right now. They aren't quite saying that either, but, you know, hey, you know, you got to take little baby steps before you start to walk. But at some point, I have to ask myself, you know, where did these people go to school? Oh, wait a minute. That's right. They went to school and learned from Keynesian professors. My mistake. Take it away. Sorry.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, I'm just reading a headline on Voice of America that you might have said, I didn't know if you got the exact figure. The president, do you say close to $900 million worth of euros?
Yeah.
Wow. That's, and if you study the, you know, what that really means is, gosh, times that by at least 10, that would be, let's see, 9,000 million.
9 billion.
The, 9 billion. So, yeah, that's probably a very large chunk of the the Greek banking system.
Yeah, we're not talking about a large system. We're talking about a system that's probably smaller than J.P. Morgan.
Right.
Another interesting article, though, that I saw, this is from The Guardian, and it came out, it came out yesterday. The headline of the article pretty much says it all. The headline says, cost of Greek exit from Euro put at $1 trillion. Now, that's quite a headline. Think about it. As we just said, you know, roughly, 3% of the European economy is the Greek economy. So it's this little tiny piece of the economy, and yet a Greek exit would cost $1 trillion in euros. I mean, that if there is any other piece of information that you could possibly see that should at least, you know, shake your credulity about, you know, the viability of a fractional reserve system and the viability of fiat money, that would be it. And yet, I have to say, I imagine most people look at that and they just kind of draw a blank. They don't really quite get it. How could there be that big of a loss from, you know, the Greek nation leaving the euro?
Yeah, well, I'd be interested to know how exactly they got to that figure, but, you know, you have a lot of these derivatives that are tied into it. Maybe it's no mistake that J.P. Morgan came out and said that they just took a $2 billion trading loss the other day. But, and how much of that estimate is tied into people losing confidence in the currency and the debt of the other countries? Because, you know, in theory, you know, if this... if you had a hard money system or if you had a constant supply of money, you know, for one country to leave it and go back, what would that generate? That would, to the drachma or whatever, that would generate, you know, more transactional costs, like when you're going from one currency to another. But, you know, beyond that, really, you know, not much at all. So,
the biggest cost would be to the people who hold deposits in the Greek banks. I mean, they're obviously going to be the biggest losers in that kind of scenario because if you go from the euro to a renewal of the drachma, and of course it's a big question whether or not they even have new drachmas prepared up and stored anywhere, but assuming that they do and they are able to, you know, get that back into circulation, in order to cover the losses of the banks, the only way they're going to be able to do that is basically through what we talked about very, very much earlier in this discussion, which was essentially printing money out of thin air. And this is where the real printing money out of thin air would come from, because essentially they would print more paper than they can claim the value to be so that they can cover the losses. That's the only way to do it if you don't have a central bank backing you. So what we would be facing in Greece, or what the Greeks would be facing, would be an instant inflation, and that instant inflation, that's what basically gets the whole contagion going. It's not so much that the inflation isn't there; it's that if it gets noticed, it starts working its way into economic transactions, and when that happens, that's where you start getting all the other contagions taking place, all the other countries that have the same kind of fiat banking system with the same kind of losses on their books. All of a sudden, now they're threatened with the possibility of the exact same kind of bank run. So,
yeah, and I'm curious too, because all these people taking the $900 million out, certainly a pretty massive withdrawal, and €1 inside the EU, any euro bill is the equivalent of any other. However, in the serial numbers on the bills themselves, you can tell which money is coming from Germany or issued or belongs to Germany, and which ones belong to the other countries in the EU. And I kind of wonder, you know, how much of that money that the banks paid out to the depositors, again, €1 worth another, have that type of tracking, because if they're handing out all the money that has the grease on it, all they need to do is say, well, you know, if you have a serial number, trade in for drachma, and they'll still get screwed.
you can be sure of that. And, of course, most of them won't even have the serial numbers because it'll be in the bank. There's no serial numbers in the bank.
Right.
Oh, dear. Well, in the course of all of that, I made a reference to J.P. Morgan, and they've had their own troubles this week, over the past couple of weeks, because it turns out they got caught with their hands, well, not so much in the cookie jar, but more with their hands showing that they don't really know what the heck they're doing.
Right, and Barack Obama, who has, is called in recent days Jamie Dimon, the CEO, chairman, and president of J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the smartest guys we have, and I'm not sure what he meant by we. I'm not sure if he meant we as in the U.S. or we as in he and his wife, because the Obamas keep between $500,000 to $1 million in cash with J.P. Morgan, which is slightly unusual, just because J.P. Morgan is typically a commercial bank, but it's a lot of cash to be carrying. At any rate, the trading losses, this is just coming out of the New York Times, the trading losses suffered by J.P. Morgan Chase have surged in recent days, surpassing the bank's initial $2 billion estimate by at least $1 billion, according to people with knowledge of the losses. So they had to announce this due to, I guess it was probably a quarterly filing, but Jamie Dimon has indicated that the loss of $2 billion could double within the next few quarters. Initially they said that, overall their quarter they had a certain amount of profit exceeding the $2 billion. But certainly, these are tied to, certainly these were thought to initially be risk-free profits or what have you, and certainly isn't working out that way. So kind of wonder whether it's, this is just going to be a hedge fund loss type. This really is a hedge fund type loss. It's not really commercial banking. Whatever they were gambling on, I believe it was certainly derivatives, although maybe you can confirm that. But this whole thing with J.P. Morgan is certainly going to cause some more caution going into a lot of these other financial stocks. And, how can, a bank is supposed to be, people don't realize that with the fall of the Glass-Steagall Act, what this has become, which Jamie Dimon, the CEO, played a key role in, by the way, he worked with the Travelers merger in the city back in, 2002 or so. With that, these have just become, I guess the phrase casino bank has been thrown around, but it's probably a pretty, probably a pretty good name for what they're doing. It's very high risk. Doesn't have any correlation with, the conservative banker type thing that they want to portray.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in fact, the whole thing like you pointed out, these are credit default swaps, which, of course, is a term familiar to anyone who remembers 2008. And a credit default swap in this context, we'll keep it really, really simple. It's nothing more than betting that a much larger investment is not going to go wrong. Well, that alone should tell you that it's not a safe investment, because that's what the last 4 years have told us. And yet, here's J.P. Morgan, and who knows how many other banks, but here's J.P. Morgan once again taking these credit default swap bets and losing on them. And I don't think anybody really knows yet outside of J.P. Morgan and perhaps the regulators where these losses occurred. Certainly the press hasn't given us much in the way of details on it. But speculation is rampant and absolutely rampant that a lot of these losses are coming out of Europe. And that would make a lot of sense. I mean, the European crisis is basically a backlash from the American crisis, because a lot of those European banks were invested in American mortgages. And it is also a crisis that was added to, kind of like pouring gasoline on the fire kind of thing, with all the sovereign debt situations where the governments, the socialist governments basically just kept ratcheting up their borrowing. So the combination has been, predictably disastrous. And yet here we have J.P. Morgan once again investing in taking bets that, that kind of investment, investing in a country with those kinds of situations going on, it's a safe bet, so we'll bet that there won't be any major losses. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they should copy the Goldman Sachs method, which is go in well before, know exactly what they're doing in terms of the EU, know how bad it is on their books, and do the auditing, then bet against them, and then just to make sure you're going to be okay, make sure some of your alumni get elected president or prime minister or head of the European Central Bank.
God help us. I mean, we're actually talking about taking advice from Goldman Sachs. Well, but that's probably a good time for a break. After the break, we'll be talking about some other financially related situations, including how the IMF was responding to this. Plus, also, we're going to look at an article coming out of India where there is a renewed call for Indian gold bonds. And what's interesting about that one, well, we'll get to that after the break, but it's a very interesting twist on that one. Plus, Jake has some fascinating information about what's been going on with the Paul campaign, as well as U.S. relations with Israel. But we'll be touching on that after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And while we were on the break there, I kind of listened on one of those promo announcements there, the one that on the show they're going to have the clairvoyant on. And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe we should have that clairvoyant here on the show with us, Jake, because maybe he or she could tell us, you know, when's the next time J.P. Morgan's going to make another one of those really stupid credit default swap buys so we can do the Goldman Sachs position and, you know, take the position against them. What do you think?
Well, that's the thing with derivatives. You typically can't take a position against them because it's it needs to have very large dollar amounts. A lot of these, you know, the OTC market. I would ask the clairvoyant what the price of gold is going to be in a year.
Well, you know, speaking of gold, the IMF. Interesting thing happened. Website commodityonline.com came out with a report earlier in the week that said that the IMF was planning to buy $2.3 billion worth of gold for their reserves. And then a couple days later, they backed off on the report, saying that the IMF has only stated that it plans to increase its reserves. Nothing about gold, you see.
Okay.
I think perhaps somebody at the IMF, maybe in a private conversation, revealed too much to somebody at commodityonline.com. I don't know, just speculating, but that's the way it looked to me. But it is interesting to note that the IMF is taking action to increase their reserves with whatever fiat money they decide to do it with. And they're doing that, of course, because of what's going on over in Europe. Because as the situation deteriorates more and more, the IMF will be one of those, I guess you might call it a pseudo-central bank, that will be looked to help, you know, bail them out. Because that's what the banks do, isn't it? They get bailed out.
Yep. But, you know, again, the whole fallacy is, you know, let's keep printing more money and throwing at it, and that's just not going to work. I mean, if we could solve all the problems in the long term, I should say, it's not going to work. In the short term or even years, obviously, it does work. That's what they've been doing. But
yeah, they've been doing it for so long. You know, why should it end now, right?
Right.
Never mind how it's, you know, basically impoverishing everyone along the way. I've had some interesting discussions with people online about that. I don't know if you remember, about a year ago, I did a rebuttal video to something that Robert Reich put up on YouTube, or, you know, one of his cronies put up on YouTube. And the rebuttal video that I put up hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, maybe 1,000 viewers or something like that. But among those who have seen it, you basically get two kinds of reactions. You either get, oh, yeah, right on, glad to hear that somebody's actually telling this side of the story. Or you hear, you have no idea. How did this guy ever get on YouTube? You don't get anything in the middle. There's no middle ground on it. And one of the key, I can't say key, that's not right, one of the consistent themes that comes out of the camp that thinks I'm full of, you know, bananas or whatever, is that I don't, according to them, I don't understand just how useful and valuable the current fiat monetary system is. I don't appreciate just how much wealth it has given us. And I keep making the argument to them in both in comments on YouTube and in private email exchanges that, you know, people just keep getting hurt. Every time that the money supply expands, at some point later on down the line, the value of the money decreases and the people who hold that money get hurt. And it's like they can't even hear that argument. You know, they'll do everything they can to avoid it. So it's been fascinating to watch, because the Keynesians certainly have their army of supporters, and it looks like they're going to basically go down fighting all the way, regardless of what the facts show.
Yeah. Should be good to, well, it might not be very pleasant to see it, but in the long run is what's going to happen to them.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's true, no doubt about it. Well, we have some more financial news to talk about, but I think we need a break from that. So let's kind of go to something that's a little bit off financial news. Let's go to what's going on between the U.S. and Israel. Well, actually, that's not such good news either, but it is kind of important.
What's
the scoop here? Is Israel going to attack Iran? What's the deal?
Well, the tensions in the area are increasing. There was a recent Iranian election that was not in Ahmadinejad's favor. It was in the Ayatollah's favor. So, you know, Iran is kind of tilting more towards theocracy. And from the Western point of view, it probably doesn't make, too much more sense, because the U.S. and other countries would probably like to see them go further away from the Ayatollah, which is actually what Ahmadinejad represented when he was first elected. Regardless of that, he is losing power. And the religion stuff is taking place, which I think is probably a very consequence of all these sanctions. They're blaming Ahmadinejad for them, and also, of course, publicly they gave the responses that he wasn't supporting what the Ayatollahs wanted, or he contradicted what they said. So, you know, that's not good for really anyone. But out of Israel today, we decided to send a diplomat to address the envoy to Israel. So it sounds like it's the ambassador, and he gave a speech to the Israel Bar Association that said that that the United States has plans in place to attack Iran if necessary to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons, which, you know, again. He didn't even say that they had nuclear weapons. He said to prevent it, which again is just kind of like what we did in Iraq. We went in there to prevent them from having weapons of mass destruction that they did not have. so this is another preemptive war. And the Israeli military, one of the key generals, Major General Ido Nehushtan, said even a few days ago, he commands their Air Force, said that the Air Force is prepared for any scenario, including striking Iranian nuclear facilities. Now, Dan Shapiro, the envoy from Washington, did state that the U.S. hopes it will not have to resort to military force. But then he said, quote, "But that doesn't mean that option is not fully available. Not just available, but it's ready," he said, quote. "The necessary plan has been done to ensure that it's ready," unquote. So what he's really saying is the U.S. military has been working on war plans against Iran, and I think the American public probably isn't aware of that. And last time I checked, there wasn't a congressional declaration of war.
I recognize anything like that from Congress, although I can't say I much recognize Congress anymore, but that's another story.
They probably don't even know what's going on.
Well, I think that's pretty evident for the things that they say. But the thing that I kept thinking about as you were describing what's going on there, and you placed very good emphasis on the fact that this whole scenario is about preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Now, we keep hearing that. We keep hearing that from the military leaders of the U.S., from the military leaders of Iran, and yet American conservatives and even warmongering American moderates, they all keep talking as if Iran already has nuclear weapons or is on the verge of having them. The disconnect is just startling. It's absolutely startling. It's like they hear the news. It's always saying the same thing, and yet, like, there's this little translator inside their head saying, whenever you hear the words, prevent them from getting nukes, translate that into, they almost have them.
Well, another quote from Shapiro, from USA Today. He said that in relationship to how much time is left, that they have preparations are all ready to go. He said that, quote, "We do believe there is time," referring to, when they're going to attack. "Some time, but not an unlimited amount of time. But at a certain point, we may have to make a judgment that diplomacy will not work," unquote. And excuse me, but he's addressing the Israeli Bar Association.
Probably just
the Iranians at every point, they have welcomed it in, and I forget the, maybe you recall, but I remember we were covering them, and they not only gave, you know, had multiple meetings with the IAEA, but the IAEA asked to get into a secret military site that they, you know, were conjecturing would have weapons, and Iran did give, took them several days or possibly a week, but they did give permission. I haven't seen the results of that audit, which must have taken place, and the reason why I haven't seen the results is probably because they didn't find anything.
That can't be the case, because, you know, what's the argument? The argument is, you know, we got to prevent them from getting the nukes. That means
right.
they don't have them yet. So they've got
to
be there.
Prevent them from getting it.
But they've got to be there. That's what that means, right?
Right.
Oh, God. Oh, it's so wonderful to be an American. Well, let's go back to the financial news, because it's probably better than the Iranian news. One interesting article that I saw came out of India, and I mentioned this one before the break, and this is a little bit fascinating. This comes from mindweb.com. Let me just read a little bit of what the article says. It's probably better than trying to explain it. In a major effort to mobilize the vast gold in the country and to reduce imports of the precious metal, the Indian government is contemplating a proposal to issue gold bonds. India accounts for nearly one-third of the total world demand for gold, though it might soon cede that position to China. While India's apex bank, the Reserve Bank of India, is considering the idea of issuing government gold bonds to attract dollar inflows from non-resident Indians and to help stabilize the rupee, which has slipped to a record low, the government is also said to be deliberating gold bonds for infrastructure companies. Quote, the idea is to throttle gold imports, but this alternative investment avenue will help savings-challenged Indian consumers with pretty much the same attributes of positive real rates of return while keeping risk to the minimum, said an investment banker, unquote. Now, I don't know about you, Jake, but I read an article about like this where it says that they want to create gold-based bonds because they want to reduce the flow of gold. And I say, they really want people to believe that? I mean, the whole point, if you take them at their word, if you take them at their word, the whole point of issuing gold-based bonds is so that people can have an easy way to acquire gold. So why then would you hope to keep gold out of the country? The only reason I can possibly conceive of, and of course I think you probably know where I'm going with this, is that they have no intention of keeping the value of the bonds equal to the gold that is supposedly being held. In other words, they're planning to inflate the bonds.
Oh, sure.
I mean, how can anyone even read this article? And this is, I'm sure, being read in India, but how can anybody in India read this article and not think that they're being set up to be robbed? That's the part I don't get.
I don't think it's going to work very well because just culturally, you know, the form of the gold takes, that most gold in India takes place is jewelry. So
yeah, that's true.
It probably has a pretty low chance of working, but yeah, it's sounds to me like it's just another effort to generate more paper vehicles with gold and to stop, you know, one of the, you know, largest consumers of physical gold from acquiring any more.
It's almost as if the ETFs that trade in gold aren't enough for the Indian government. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe the Indian government wants their own form of an ETF, and they don't really want it to be an ETF. They want it to be something that's more easily manipulable. Maybe that's what it's about, so that the central bank in India can essentially do the same thing that the other central banks have been doing, and that is, you know, keeping the price of gold down to make it look like there's no inflation going on. Maybe that's what this is.
Sort of like their own government debt.
That would be interesting to look at. I wonder how high Indian government debt is. Yeah. That would be very interesting to look at. Well, we'll have to take a look at that at another time. Let's look at the other stuff that's been going on around the world with the United States involvement. How about Central America? Anything good happening in Central America these days?
Not so much. We covered, I think a couple weeks ago, we covered how in San Diego, California, the federal DEA arrested a college student for drug use, locked him in a cell, then forgot about him for 5 days. He almost died of renal failure after being forced to drink his own urine to survive. And in that show, we talked about how the DEA has offices and officers, over 10,000 employees, a budget of operating budget of $2 billion, and offices I'm not really sure if office is the right word, offices and armories in 65 countries.
Sure.
But out of published on the Huffington Post, then recovered on antiwar.com, the U.S. DEA, according to a Honduran newspaper, as well as the Honduran human rights group, COFADE, agents of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency dressed up in military uniforms killed at least four and possibly six civilians in a raid which took place on Friday, May 11th. The victims included two pregnant women and two children. These were all, according to the newspaper, were humble and honest citizens, unquote. And apparently the DEA agents fired from helicopter gunships onto a boat carrying civilians from across a stream or over the ocean from one island to the mainland. And the DEA mistakenly fired upon the civilian boat because it was well lit, while its intended target, you know, the people that they intended to kill, was a boat carrying drug traffickers, was floating down the river without its lights on to try, you know, to avoid, you know, getting shot and killed.
Sounds like it worked.
The coming out of antiwar.com, they now say that some officials are now saying that U.S. was involved but wasn't actually the people doing the shooting, which just sounds a bit like a cop-out to me. But we do have, in addition to the DEA agents, we have more than 600 U.S. troops stationed in Honduras. And there's at least, by the end of 2011, it states 42 Honduran law enforcement agencies were working with the DEA. So it's possible that some of those people were shooting the civilians otherwise. But the Obama administration has its past history of supporting a military coup in 2009, which removed the democratically elected José Manuel Zelaya. And again, the U.S. Favoring the election or the removal of democratically elected officials, you know, despite all the, you know, the cries for, you know, for democracy or what have you, is not very good record. I think it was under Nixon that Pinochet took the rise on in Chile. We've done it in almost every single. I would actually have a hard time naming a country where we haven't done it in South America and Latin America. So just kind of more of the same. And you know, there's a lot of concern that you know what this is doing. You know, the U.S. troops are and the DEA are kind of militarizing. You know, the police force in Honduras, because you know. If they are doing something wrong, it certainly shouldn't be a helicopter gunship either paid for or staffed by or with shooters from the United States. So, and again, this, you know, this is something that I certainly didn't see anywhere in the U.S. press.
No, it doesn't get any coverage at all in the U.S. press. What did get coverage was the 60 bodies or so that were dumped by the drug lords from Mexico. But, yeah, I didn't hear anything about this one, that's for sure. Well, we're still not doing real well finding that one good piece of news. Let's try going to the Ron Paul campaign. That's usually got, you know, something good going on. What's happening there?
Okay, well, the Ron Paul campaign is continuing to have delegate successes across the country as things move on. However, what I wanted to actually cover was the media kind of blew up saying that the Ron Paul was pulling out of the race, which is not the truth. But on May 14th, the Ron Paul campaign did put out a very, I would say, ambiguous press release, or it kind of makes even me question exactly what the heck they're doing, saying that, yes, they're going to move ahead with pursuing obtaining delegates in the states, but that they are going to stop campaigning and spending money in the states that have primaries remaining. And the reason given was that they're just running out of money, and it says that they don't have tens of millions, although they do have millions of dollars left. And it brings to my mind, and maybe have some comments, you know, exactly why you would do this. Because even if you don't have the money, but you're planning to stay in until the convention, you might as well not publish it. It's, you know, the only reason I can kind of think of is they want the voter turnouts to be extremely low. It could be completely unattested, and that would, of course, favor Ron Paul, because as we've seen, and you know, his really hasn't. I think the highest vote total he got was 35%, but he's typically getting around 10 to 15%. But those people, I would say, are going to show up rain or shine, regardless of anybody else. So
he got 40% in Virginia, but you're right; he hasn't gotten any really high numbers.
Right, and so. You know, the following day, there was such a consternation that they had to give out another press release by Jesse Benton, the campaign strategist and manager. And, you know, it says that Dr. Paul is not dropping out or suspending his campaign. But then it goes on to say that pretty much, I guess I should just quote it, quote, "Unfortunately, barring something very unforeseen, our delegate total will not be strong enough to win the nomination. Governor Romney is now within 200 delegates of securing the party's nod. However, our delegates can still make a major impact at the National Convention and beyond," unquote. And that's in itself kind of conceding things a bit, but it's also using, you know, when he said that they're 200 delegates short, that's using the mainstream media's delegate estimation counts, which are not correct, and probably just based on the results out of Maine, Minnesota, Iowa, which he won, and Nevada and several other states, including Massachusetts, I would say even the delegates on the first round voting, Ron Paul's probably picked up about 100 out of the ones that they already have slotted to give to Romney. So, you know, that means that Romney, don't get me wrong, is still the front runner in the race. He's probably going to get the nomination, but he probably won't have the delegates counted up for another few months, even after the Texas and California elections coming up.
Well, we're still not doing real well trying to come up with some good news. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I've got the perfect story. This is a great way to wrap up the show. You're going to love this one because
okay.
You remember earlier in the show we were lauding Goldman Sachs, right, about how savvy they are with all these financial trades and so forth.
I wasn't lauding them. I was just saying, you know, if
sorry, I didn't mean to misquote you.
Freak the trading.
Well, there's a great article that appeared in Rolling Stone, and I just want to quote some of this article. This is an article by, I hope I pronounced his name right, Matt Taibbi.
Yeah, Taibbi.
And it's the article is called "Accidentally Released and Incredibly Embarrassing Documents Show How Goldman et al. Engaged in Naked Short Selling." This appeared just a couple days ago. And the article says, "It doesn't happen often, but sometimes God smiles on us. Last week he smiled on investigative reporters everywhere when the lawyers for Goldman Sachs slipped on one whopper of a legal banana peel, inadvertently delivering some of the bank's darker secrets into the hands of the public. The lawyers for Goldman and Bank of America Merrill Lynch have been involved in a legal battle for some time, primarily with the retail giant Overstock.com, but also with Rolling Stone, The Economist, Bloomberg, and The New York Times. The banks have been fighting us to keep sealed certain documents that surfaced in the discovery process of an ultimately unsuccessful lawsuit filed by Overstock against the banks. Last week, in response to an Overstock.com motion to unseal certain documents, the bank's lawyers, apparently accidentally, filed an unredacted version of Overstock's motion as an exhibit in their declaration of opposition to that motion. In doing so, they inadvertently entered into the public record a sort of greatest hits selection of the very material they've been fighting for years to keep sealed.
Oh,
I contacted Morgan Lewis, the firm that represents Goldman in this matter, earlier today, but they haven't commented as of yet. I wonder if the poor lawyer who foobarred this terrible thing has already had his organs harvested. His panic is almost palpable in the air. So Rolling Stone's having a good time because it looks like Goldman's lawyers absolutely, totally screwed up. There is hope in this world. Well, unfortunately, we're at the end of an hour, and I'm glad that we finally found something good to happen at the end of this hour, because the news has been particularly bad and probably will be for some time. But, Jake, as usual, your reporting was very spot on. Thank you very much.
Yeah, try my best.
And we will see you all next. What was that?
Sorry, it wasn't good news. Maybe we'll
get some news in next week. That's good news if we can. And in the meantime, we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Peace.